You're listening to the Wine Country Live Morning Show with Barry Martin
on KVON Napa, 1440 AM at KVON.com.
It's time once again for our COVID catch-up. We like to stay on top of what's news in the coronavirus world, and joining us right now is Dr. John Kirk. Good morning. Welcome back.
Good morning, Barry. Great to be back.
And
a little early this morning.
Yeah. Well, you know, you got to burn that oil 24 hours a day, right? Stay on top. Let's get right into it. The focus has been almost totally on vaccines for the last few weeks, appropriately so, but sort of out of balance with talking about treatments and therapeutics and so on. And as I recall, a few months ago, we talked about how it takes both of those things to really get over the pandemic. We're going to focus a little bit on the therapeutics here to get started, treatment that's available if you do catch the COVID-19.
That sounds right. You know, if you can prevent it, that's excellent. The problem is it takes time to prevent it. And as we see, it takes time to get those vaccine jabs into the arm. That said, we may be getting some seriously good news on vaccines July or August, when we have reached herd immunity. At least that's our hope. But for the time being, people are still getting sick. We've just sadly reached 500,000 deaths in our country, as we've heard. We have something close to 2.5 million worldwide. This ranks pretty high up in the world pandemics from the beginning of history, but there are several that are far worse. So we've got people to treat. There are still people in the hospital. There are still many, many deaths, anywhere from 1,000 to 3,000 a day still, although that seems to be going down now as that trailing indicator we talk about. First you get sick, then you get admitted, then you die. Hopefully that doesn't happen to us. And why? We maybe have some treatments. It's been difficult. We talked about treatments here, and it's been very difficult to find things that work or that we can prove work. There are some, however, so kind of break them up into when you get it. It's kind of hard. You get sick. You want to get feeling better as soon as possible. What do? You call your doctor, right?
I would do that.
Yeah, that just makes sense that we're supposed to be the experts. The reality is most of us really probably don't know how to access treatments for patients. Mm-hmm. It's not easy. What are the treatments? Well, before you get sick, you know, the best thing is to prevent you from getting into the hospital. So there's three or four things that have been tested out there. Some have been granted emergency use authorization by the FDA. One, convalescent plasma. This is something that we've talked about for years. It's fairly safe. It's considered very safe, actually, notwithstanding a transfusion reaction, because this is essentially the derivative of blood plasma that carries the antibodies to whatever problems. It has to be cleaned and sorted, and it has to be matched per person. You can't just give anybody's plasma, because it has the potential for a transfusion reaction. Short of that, though, it's been used off and on for many, many years in varying different types of diseases. So convalescent plasma is something we've talked about here. It's got to have high levels of antibodies to be beneficial. Otherwise, it seems to be somewhat of a waste of time. There's issues. If you don't get it in the first few days of the treatment, of the symptoms, then it really just doesn't work. However, for people, for example, 65 or over, that had the convalescent plasma in that time period, about 50% of them had less symptoms, significantly less severe symptoms, helping not to get them admitted to the hospital. So that's one option.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got these things called monoclonal antibodies. So this is the medicine that Regeneron, for example. We heard Regeneron, the company, creating two meds called, Casirivimab and Imdivimab. Yes, those are very easy to pronounce. From Regeneron, those are two individual monoclonal antibodies that together become polyclonal, right? So they've given this to patients with some benefit, some significant benefit, as long as, again, it gets in there within 7 days of a positive test. There's our favorite. Remember, we have Bamlanivimab. I've practiced that, by the way. You can actually go online You can. You can go online and look for the pronunciation information for Bam Melendimab. I practiced it several times. That's Eli Lilly. So that works pretty well, too.
It's almost like a Saturday Night Live skit when you say those names, you know?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I could definitely see that. Actually, it'd probably be much more fun. So basically, all of these monoclonal antibodies need to be given within 7 days. Otherwise, they haven't been shown to have any benefit. But again, an option to give to a patient prior to being hospitalized, prior to receiving oxygen therapy. So their problem with the monoclonal antibodies is they're just not getting delivered. It's very difficult to find where to get them. If you call your doctor and say, hey, I heard about these monoclonal antibodies, where can I get that bamlanivimab? They'll say, what? What are you talking about? What language? In all seriousness, though, it is very difficult to get them. Many hospitals do not have it. Many of the hospitals in our inner cities where the burden of disease is even worse don't have access to them or are not as familiarized with delivering those drugs. They need to be in an infusion center. You have to be watched for several hours after the infusion is given because there are allergic reactions. So challenges there. And then we've heard of remdesivir. That's one of the ones we've been talking about from the beginning. Again, something that really needs to be given prior to patients getting into the hospital wherever possible. That said, it was actually developed for Ebola. You remember Ebola? That was a pretty significant disease. It killed about, God, I think about 11,000 people or something like that, and then just kind of burned itself out because it was such a strong killer. But that's where remdesivir came in, where they were developing it to treat Ebola. It seemed to work against that, and it has shown some benefit against the SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19 disease virus. But there's questions about how well it works. At the end of the day, those are really it for before you get in the hospital. Then when you do, unfortunately, get into the hospital, there's increasing treatment options that seem to really be stemming the tide. Certainly we've seen incredible numbers when you look at, you know, some days we had 200,000 plus each day that were getting the disease. We overburdened all of our hospitals or many of our hospitals and our ICUs. So how can we get them treated so that they don't end up in the ICU? How do we do that so they don't end up dying? Oxygen therapy, smartly done, not necessarily trying to get them intubated, because that's a death knell. Once you get that intubation, it's a very, very significant risk for death. So if we can keep that from happening, that's a good thing. One thing that they would do is put patients face down, right? Just literally on their belly so that the lungs have less pressure, because gravity is sort of helping pull the chest wall away, and it makes it easier, less difficult for the patient, him or herself, to breathe. Kind of an interesting thought. It's logical. It seems to work quite well. But then there's medications. So one of the biggest problems that we've talked about is the idea of inflammatory changes or cytokines. These are the things that our own bodies release to battle infections. It's a good thing, bad thing time. You know, if you have too many of these cytokines, they can start to injure the body. Inflammatory changes occur, causing damage to the lungs, damage to the heart, and other many different. You heard, remember the COVID toes? That's a relationship to inflammatory changes. So we've come up with steroids, right? Steroids have been around for years. We use dexamethasone or betamethasone to treat varying types of allergies that lead to inflammatory changes. We all get swollen up and edematous and hives. Those things are treated by steroids, right? Seems to work quite well. It's probably one of the best treatments that we've come up with and we've had all of this time in order to help treat the inflammatory processes that are going on. We can give actually inhibitors to the cytokines, and that may benefit as well, although the results have been a little bit mixed. These are some other ones that are pronunciation horrors. We've got tocilizumab and sarilumab. So those are the ones that are out there. Somewhat mixed results, but still being used and with some success. In the hospital, we've got anticoagulants. So anticoagulants, remember when you heard about people having blocked blood vessels, having strokes, COVID toes, again, with inflammatory changes, also having blocked blood vessels that causes the toes to die, if you will. This is a real reason, not the toes per se, but the blockage of blood vessels that has led to several deaths. And so anticoagulants like heparin, those types of medicines are given to prevent blood clots, and they seem to be very, very beneficial as well. So there's those things out there. There's not a lot more.
And you know, it stands out to me in starkly that, as you mentioned, some of these things, convalescent plasma, the monoclonal antibodies, we've heard about people who are seen as VIPs or, you know, significant individuals who have to have the utmost treatment. Those kind of people seem to get those things. I doubt that much of us common folk do. You know, if I were to become sick with COVID-19 and I'm a Kaiser patient and I say, hey, can I get some of that convalescent plasma, some of those monoclonal antibodies, doc? What are the likelihoods that I would see that result?
I don't know, but we just had a power failure. How fun is that?
You did?
We did, yeah. It's been the second time today, but in any case.
I'm sorry.
No, no worries. I can still talk. That's good. And I hear you, so that's good, too. Long story short, you're right. We saw how easy it seemed to be for President Trump at the time to get essentially everything that was there and then some. And then brag about it. That does not happen. It's like I said earlier, it's very difficult to even get these in some of our hospitals. And when we get them, who's really going to get those drugs? They're going to be the ones that are the sickest, but then that leaves out many of these options for people like you and I who might get the disease and have to, quote, stay at home. Remember, mm-hmm. we've been told, stay at home, at home, don't come in.
Right.
So it is a challenge for sure. And I think that part will continue to be a challenge, expensive, difficult to administer, and many people just don't have access to them.
Let's swing our attention around to the vaccine topics. And one of the questions right now, talking about a single vaccine here, this is a new angle, one vaccine that would work against all coronaviruses. That's pretty ambitious.
The one ring that will bind them all. Right? Well, I like that laugh. That was very good.
Yes.
Pan-coronavirus vaccine. So pan means basically all or everything. The idea is not as new. We have known about coronaviruses, for example, probably since the 60s or before. They're the ones that cause colds. And then all of a sudden we had SARS-CoV-1 in 2002, 2003. Pretty scary, but again, burned itself out quickly. Then we had MERS, another coronavirus, in, I think, 2012 to 14. Again, real scary, but burned itself out. So during those times and earlier, in I think 1996 is when they started looking at the pan-coronavirus, money was there. They put the money out because they were concerned the potential was going to be really bad for this coronavirus. And it didn't pan out, so they threw the money away or they got rid of it and the research dried up. But there are now many indications that getting a pan coronavirus will be a panacea in many ways for us. We talk now about variants, right, and mutants. The worry is that the existing vaccines are not going to be beneficial or will become less and less beneficial. And there's definitely some proof suggesting that at this point. If we had a pan coronavirus, this would be one that could treat any of changes or mutations in the vaccine, the virus. So looking to do that and now having motivation, there'll be more money pushed towards it. And there are now several labs trying to develop that pan coronavirus vaccine. We saw how amazing the process was with our current vaccines that are being distributed. In terms of the timing, we are looking forward to perhaps even within a year getting something like a pan coronavirus that may replace what we have out on the market currently, and hoping that may be a one dose and done type of thing, or one dose with a a booster shot, but not one that would have to be replaced every time the mutations take over. So that's a very hopeful process for our future.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about a couple of pregnancy-related topics. You are, of course, an OBGYN. You knew that, though. And we're taking a look at two factors. You mentioned here that there was a rumor about COVID vaccines and fertility. And I always hate repeating rumors because then they spread, even if they aren't true. Talk about that a little bit. What are we discussing here?
So one of the things that we find from our anti-vax crowd out there is the use of social media. We've been discussing that here and, of course, politically as well. And in the past probably 3 weeks or so, there's been this increasing rumor mill started. I think it was on Facebook, even though they said that they would shut down things that weren't scientifically based. And it was sent out that said that the shot or our vaccine would cause the immune system to attack the placenta in pregnant women and that it would potentially lead to miscarriage and infertility. Now, that was kind of out there. There was nothing up to that point that would have suggested anything like that. And so the people who do this anti-vaxxing, they're not stupid. They have a different agenda. So they came up with this thing called syncytin 1. It's one of the proteins, a very significant protein that's inside a placenta. I'm sure none of us really have heard about that until this probably came out, unless you're a scientist working in that field. I certainly hadn't heard of that specific protein. And it is purportedly, and here's the key, purportedly similar in structure to the spike protein, this coronavirus spike protein. And somehow, because of the similarity, the purported similarity, the argument was that the vaccine would attack it mistakenly. Well, number one, that doesn't happen. Viruses don't tend to make a lot of mistakes. Coronaviruses don't make a lot of mistakes in the sense that they don't even mutate that much. We talk about it all the time, but they actually have devices within themselves to correct any of the potential errors when they are mutating, so to speak, or trying to mutate, which is something that all life does going through its process in evolution. It's what ultimately leads to evolution. The problem is the syncytin 1 protein doesn't look anything like the spike protein. There's almost nothing in similarity to it. It's just a set of words put on paper to scare us. So fortunately, we do have some scientists that looked at that and said, this makes absolutely no sense. So that's the challenge. There's literally no sense made, but it sounds good when you read their arguments. And so it does scare people. There were doctors who were pregnant that were not taking the vaccine because of seeing this until, fortunately, those people talked to others who knew and they corrected their ways. So please don't think that the vaccine is going to impact your fertility. In fact, there's been, I think, 10,000 pregnancies after the vaccine within a very short periods of time. Certainly that didn't occur. There hasn't been any suggestions of any increased loss or risk to pregnancies that have received the vaccine, either those that weren't knowledgeably pregnant at the time but happened to be, or that immediately got pregnant afterwards. And given that we've had something on the order of 38 million shots distributed, excuse me, now 60-something million shots distributed in this country, there's bound to be, you know, several thousand pregnancies, and nothing has been reported of any concern so far.
Hmm. Now, I don't want to ambush you, but did you see this item from the Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology? I just had a bit on this today earlier about a study in Washington State that appears to show more likelihood for pregnant women to become positive for the coronavirus. Have you had a chance to see that?
More likely to get coronavirus?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've seen that specifically. I was looking the morning before our show, and I didn't see it.
Literally, it was just a couple of hours ago that I saw this. Between March and June, the COVID-19 rate in pregnant women was 70% higher than in non-pregnant adults.
Nice. Well, either you don't get pregnant, and then you won't have to deal with that, or... you just pray, or you get the vaccine.
There was no indication of any negative outcomes or anything, just that the I guess they're pointing to a possible tendency to be more likely to get infected. That's all.
It kind of makes it makes sense in some ways. Pregnant women have a slightly decreased immune response. And so in theory, it's easier to get sick in general. So flu, for example, probably easier for pregnant women to get it. And it's certainly much more dangerous for a pregnant woman to get the flu. There's data that suggests it may be 6 times or 600% more likely to die from the flu if you're pregnant. Another reason to get your flu vaccine, notwithstanding the anti-vaxxers. But there's initially, when we looked at pregnancy, there was a lot of discussion about it probably being worse, including the stat that you just said, not specific stats, but just the idea that they may get it more frequently, if not worse. And it took us a long time to really prove that it was worse. So it's interesting that the data from, you know, May or March to June was just released today. But that's been true about how sick they get, whether they get admitted to the hospital, whether they get intubated, and whether they die. There was a long time where we weren't certain that it was worse, but almost all of those stats are slightly or significantly worse in pregnant patients.
Dr. John Kirk from the Adventist Healthcare System. He is an OBGYN and is ready to answer your questions. How do we get in touch with you?
You can call me anytime almost anytime at 707-253-1135. But you certainly can go online to johnhkirkmd.com and both ask questions as well as schedule appointments. And there's good information there for you.
There you go. Thanks for your time and expertise today. We'll talk soon.
Always good, sir. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Wine Country Live Morning Show with Barry Martin
on KVON Napa, 1440 AM at KVON.com.